I do think it's pretty honorable. A man comes to your house, locks the door, puts padlocks all over your door, and says, "Pay me $20 to get in." And you're like, "Fine," and he does it. But like,
but you salute, he's gonna do you it salute again. Him on the way in. Episode of Wonkcast, the independent student podcast of GW Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. My name is Eli Richman. I'll be your moderator today. My co-host today is Gabe Moss.
Hello.
We have a special guest today, Jacob Asida, going to talk to us about data breaches and cybersecurity policy. Jacob is also a grad student at GW. He's studying some of these issues, and he also runs a podcast called Decrypted, where he talks in depth about these issues. So, Jacob, can you tell us a little bit about your background with this issue and your podcast?
Sure. I'm a graduate student studying cybersecurity and computer science, and like you said, you know, I've helped run a podcast. I started the podcast. I'm also part of the GW CyberCorps Scholarship for Service. It's a government-run scholarship program for lots of areas of domains, but mostly under cybersecurity. And, you know, I've also had just a general work experience in the area. And as I say on my podcast, I'm your friendly neighborhood Cyberman. So those are my excellent credentials for you.
All right, great. Well, we're glad to have you on the show today. We've touched on, I think, some cybersecurity and tech policy in previous episodes, but we haven't had many segments just completely devoted to it. So I think to start us off, I want to talk about something that I brought up on a few other podcasts, and that's the lack of a federal data breach notification law. So right now, you know, if a company experiences a data breach as part of their normal activities, there's no federal law that says they have to notify the public in X amount of time or they get penalized. There isn't one. There are many state laws that do the same thing, but nothing at the federal level. So, Jacob, do you think, first of all, this is a problem?
I'd say it is a problem. To not have considering the ubiquity and just the size of the internet and basically everyone being connected here, not having a federal breach law is pretty bad. It's pretty good that most of the states have very similar quality sort of laws, but there are some that don't have it at all, and the varying degrees of the law doesn't provide a great landscape. I think we should be fairly consistent about cybersecurity. We shouldn't really leave it up to interpretation of states in that matter.
Is that what's driving this? Is just this idea of interpreting it on the state level, devolving the federal government down to states? Is that kind of how it is, or is it grown from states and we just haven't gotten to the federal level yet?
That's a really good question. To be honest, there's been a lot of attempts at the federal. I mean, this is, you've probably heard a couple times, you know, there's been a couple federal breach laws introduced. I think about every 2 years they introduce one, but they always get shot down. So I would say, for the most part, the U.S. in terms of cybersecurity has been pretty good about going from top down, so the federal down. Usually the states are the ones that lag behind. But in some areas, you know, if, for instance, I'm thinking like states have more, they have much stronger laws for like revenge porn or things like that. They're usually able to advance more on some specific new technical laws. But in terms of breach law, I'd say it really should be the federal who's guiding that, just because it should be something that's consistent.
So, yeah, that's very much part of the view I've encountered, especially from the industry side. Industries want to have, you know, a clear law that they can abide by, and that way they don't have to pay attention to each state in which they operate and have to pay attention to each law. On the other hand, there's an argument that the state laws are sufficient because a lot of the companies that we're talking about, you know, Target, for example, Sony, that had breaches, operate in many states anyway, and so they're essentially required to abide by the strictest state law as long as they operated even a little bit in that state. Do you find that argument persuasive?
I don't find it particularly persuasive. I mean, you could then just start operating in a state that doesn't have any breach laws. And I think that there's some degree of you know, a lot of business is cooperative with breach laws, but there's also a lot of reticence to disclose your breaches just in general. I mean, I think the fact that there isn't a federal breach law kind of demonstrates a reluctance somewhat by the private sector to abide by these standards at times.
And I mean, there's just confusion, right? Like if you're operating, say you're Google and you're operating in many dozens of states at once, just considering businesses that you own or operate in physical bricks and mortar space, not to mention the fact that ubiquitously everyone with a smartphone is constantly using your service, just figuring out what state is the operating state for any given breach might be astronomically difficult day to day. And now I'm sure that there's not a daily breach at Google or most companies, but it is, I think, illustrative of
right. And the, you know, if some areas have certain disclosure laws and others have no breach laws, I mean, if you're running into this area, we're operating with a place that has no breach law, but has like a disclosure law prohibiting you from disclosing certain facts, and there's another state that has heavy breach disclosure laws, maybe you might be in violation of a disclosure law. You're disclosing too much with your breach. You might disclose personal information about people within that breach. Usually that wouldn't happen, but that's definitely a distinct possibility, especially when you're working with like a big company like Google. I'm sure they'd much prefer to have a simple kind of guidelines for the entirety of working with the United States.
So, I mean, if the idea is pick the state that's most stringent on a given breach law for a company operating in a given set of states, why not just aggregate the most strict breach law to the entirety of the United States to most broad strokes cover? Is that generally what the approach has been for proposing breach law, or is it been to adopt a new set of standards or some median set?
I'd say certainly there's a push to just adopt the strictest. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people in the tech field would probably be more for stricter laws than that, at least in the cybersecurity domain. So I'm sure that some people just working in the tech domain don't feel that way. But I'd say that there are some degree of disadvantages and advantages to that. So if you have a very strict law in this case, you know, you might be covering things that maybe shouldn't have to be putting out as disclosure if it's a fairly small business. Mm-hmm. And you're holding them these really high standards that might not be the best. I think that's definitely an argument against having like a particularly strict law. I think the federal law in this case should work as at least a baseline and allow states to work more on a case-by-case basis, especially with what they're specifically the problems that they're facing. I think that's really the intended purpose of having these state laws versus the federal law. I think so we really need to have like a core standard for the federal law first.
Before we go deeper on what how strict a law we should adopt, can we talk a little bit about what makes a compliance law strict or lax?
Yeah, that's a fairly nuanced question. So some people would argue a strict compliance law, oftentimes it involves compliance with multiple things. One of the big things is usually you have multiple documents, multiple policies that you need to be in compliance with, especially if you're like a sector that's critical. You know, for instance, a lot of infrastructure. So in the financial sector, you're going to have a lot of things that you're going to have more stricter laws rather than having, I guess the key is usually it's between guidance and requirement.
Yeah.
A lot of times federal law has started with guidance in cybersecurity and then is slowly moving towards requirement.
Right.
So usually I'd say things that involve requirements would be stricter.
Yeah. So, and what requirements do the, what forms those requirements take? I know that there's like certain amounts of time limits in which people have to report data breaches. What's like a strict time limit for?
I mean, reporting? A strict time limit would probably be like within 48 hours. Mm-hmm. You know, some allow like weeks worth of time to delay reporting a breach. Others also have criteria to have for a breach, so there has to be a certain level of harm reached. I would consider that more of a lax law because you have to get to a certain threshold before you're even required to do anything. Some don't have that requirement. I think California, for instance, doesn't have that requirement. Or maybe it does. I might be wrong on that one.
Yeah. Well, this is something that's currently up for debate because the Supreme Court considered taking a case about the standard of harm, which for listeners is a standard whereby someone who has their data stolen has to prove that that data was used maliciously against them in order to pursue action against the company who lost the data.
That's so hard. How do you do that? How do you trace that your specific information was used
in a
harmful way? I mean, like, that's...
It's really tough. I think generally the standard has been that if your data, if you can prove that your personally identifiable information was used maliciously, and you can prove that that same information was stolen in a breach, like, that's enough. Those two things are sufficient, but it still requires you as a consumer to be able to do the due diligence of, like, waiting until something bad happens, knowing it happened, and then pursuing legal action at that point.
And it also seems like it kind of misses the point of the company's responsibility to its users to just protect their data, period. I don't care if it's used maliciously. I don't
Absolutely.
Want someone getting access to my personal information. Whether or not they mean me harm, that's still wrong for a company that I trust and that I have a contract with in the terms and agreements to then violate that contract and give my data away or let it be taken. I doubt many are giving it away.
I completely agree. I argued on a previous podcast that that's why we should get rid of the standard of harm, because we should adopt just a standard of if they lost the data, they're susceptible, because that puts companies on notice.
Yeah, and it's the argument that that's too strict and would be an undue burden on companies. We're talking about soon-to-be trillion-dollar businesses, right, that are incredibly, incredibly massive in scope and should be caring about these things. Absolutely.
That's true. Although we should, to be fair, to say that these laws would also apply equally to the small guy who, you know, might have a data breach and doesn't even know about it.
Mm-hmm. I would also say quantifying harm is a fraught sort of activity. How would you quantify the value of your credit card number? Would you consider it the value of how much money you have in your bank, or would you consider it the value of the guy who was selling your credit card number for a dollar? Would you say it's worth a dollar? Would you say it's worth more? I'd say you probably think it's not worth a dollar. I mean, there's also thresholds of harm. You know, it's not just that harm occurred in some of these cases. It's also the quantity of harm and the quality of the harm. So, you know, it's judging it, especially from a consumer standpoint, is very hard. Most people don't know anything about this and really wouldn't have any idea of how to judge how much they have been harmed.
But also, identity theft in terms of stealing pictures or identifying information that can't be used in a quantitative fashion but can be used to doctor a version of you online.
Oh, sure.
That has no monetary quantification that's easy to reach, but can still be a serious psychological burden for someone.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. My cousin was a victim of that, actually. And so that's not really something that you can easily quantify. I'd agree.
Yeah.
Especially, I think in general, we're kind of hinting at it, like the idea of like what's harm in terms of breach. I brought this up to you as a topic about Cambridge Analytica. Would you consider Cambridge Analytica, you know, the Facebook kind of controversy with people's like data being quote unquote leaked, and then used by Cambridge Analytica to create profiles and make targeted ads towards these people, would you consider that a breach?
Right. I mean, I think it's a great example, because in Cambridge Analytica's case, there's a good argument that it wasn't a breach. This is information that people are giving up and then not protecting because they're not putting the privacy notifications
on. Then we got to get into human behavior and social hacking and
this is true, but I think it illustrates well like what's the value of that information. If we're saying that getting the information period like has a value for that purpose, mm-hmm. what does it mean that people are just giving that information away for free on Facebook and then not doing anything to protect it?
I think that there's a degree of, I mean, like there's obviously an assumption by people that their data would in theory not be used for that purpose, but that's not really true. I mean, if you read the terms of service, which nobody does, you know, I mean, Facebook says it doesn't sell your data, but I mean, Facebook sells your data. Everybody
does. That's its business model.
That's its business.
How it stays in business, yeah. And we can change that, right? We could put stringent rules that they can't sell your data. We could require them to encrypt all your data so it's unusable. But then we'd have to change Facebook's business model.
Right. That's why I think it's kind of interesting with the Cambridge Analytica case, is because basically the controversy surrounding it is because they didn't pay for the information. If they had just paid for the information, would it have been a story? Probably not. I mean, it certainly raises, I think people have just been kind of ignorant about like what's been going on. People clearly don't read terms of service. But I bet if you ask somebody, does Google read your emails, they'd probably say no. That the answer to that is false. I mean, have you ever used Gmail and it suggested a response to an email for you?
Yeah.
I mean, how can you argue with that? I mean, it blatantly says as much, but in its terms. But
well, and in Congress, I mean, there's a couple weeks ago, a representative of Google and a couple of tech firms came and said, look, we comb through everything people post for keywords. That might indicate that they are a potential shooter, like in the case of the Parkland shooter.
Yeah.
So it's the sort of thing where it's constantly all your data is being scrutinized and poured over. Most of it is done artificially, not an actual person, but it is. People generally live in this bubble of ignorance.
Yeah, I just want to jump in though and say, like you said, the controversy with Cambridge Analytica is that they didn't pay. I want to add, I think the controversy also comes from that it was use in people's vision to elect
absolutely.
Donald Trump.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. People don't, you know, when they look at the information that they're giving to Facebook, they don't see that as being, like, harmful information to give away. It seems like all pretty innocuous stuff. But as soon as you hear, oh, this was used to do the thing that I didn't like, then suddenly there's a problem.
I probably wouldn't have the attention if it didn't have that political element. Yeah. You're very right on that.
Last week on the radio show, or perhaps I think it was the week before last, I was with Corey on there, and we were talking about the Facebook breach. And one thing I brought up was the more interesting story that we're getting less play of here, which is Facebook is inadvertently exposing millions of European users to what is essentially a data breach when they bring European data across state lines through the NSA's security network, which is not something that is legally allowed to be applied to Europeans because it is under a law that exists here, the Patriot Act, and does not exist in Europe. So that in itself is not a data breach in terms of someone hacking the service, but is a voluntary breach of contract by Facebook when dealing with European users.
So I'm not entirely sure about the application of a recent law, but I have a good sense of it to some degree. Have you heard of the Cloud Act at all?
Not.
So, I mean, you are talking about European users. So, in theory, those shouldn't actually be allowed to be accessed. But the Cloud Act is basically something that cemented U.S.'s ability to, well, it's more through, like, a warrant. So I think that's actually less applicable in this situation. So let's actually digress from that. I'm sorry.
Okay.
What was the comment?
So what's interesting is there's a district court in Ireland that is basically saying, look, Facebook, you're doing this whether or not you intend to. Just the way you store your data is centralized in the United States. So you are exposing our users to a regulatory regime they did not approve. That is a breach of our law.
Yeah.
So either you disaggregate your European service from your American service, which is incredibly costly and interrupts basically the entire way they do international business, or you pay to compensate those European users for that loss of autonomy to the U.S. government.
Yeah, and I can't imagine segmenting something like Facebook between.
Yeah, so Facebook is going to appeal. It's going to go to the European Supreme Court. European Supreme Court doesn't look favorably on Facebook. It's not. This is not probably not going to end well in Facebook's interest. What's interesting, though, is Google and Amazon and Apple's iCloud, all these international services that operate in both the United States and Europe that bring data across from Europe to the United States to store it, will have to rethink their business models if this is considered a form of malicious breach.
Okay, actually, we'll talk about the Cloud Act, because it is fairly tied to that. It, in fact, started with an Ireland case in Microsoft.
Interesting.
So it is very much over that. You know, they have servers in Ireland, you know, and there's data there. Less about the fact that it had, you know, foreign nationals, as I'd like, like people from Ireland's data, but does the U.S. have a right to get that data that's held in Ireland? So the Cloud Act basically states that yes, with a warrant, you know, you can take that data. And so the US, I think, has been pretty bold in stating what it can acquire in terms of other countries. And I'm not saying it's necessarily bad. I'm just saying it has taken a bold stance on what it can acquire. So yeah, you're definitely getting into these situations where Facebook is kind of caught between a rock and a hard place, facing legal action in the US if it doesn't comply, and facing legal action in the EU if it does comply.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like a problem that I was trying to bring up within the states. Not having equal laws kind of could lead to that situation if we don't have similar breach laws, if one doesn't have a breach law to protect you when you are forced to disclose.
Yeah. So I'm glad we circled back to this, actually, because there's one other thing I wanted to bring up.
Sure.
Currently, we talked about how the current patchwork of notification laws in some cases causes the strictest one to be the one that companies have to obey. If the federal government did step in and pass a notification law, and it was less strict than some of those states, the federal law takes precedent, and the states with the stricter laws, those laws would no longer be applicable.
Is that necessary? I mean, you could still have the laws be applicable.
My understanding is that the federal law would just override them.
Okay, it depends. I mean, some statutes, you can rely on statutory law versus federal law at times. I mean, it depends on the specificity of the law, of how you're working with it. I mean, you can rely on statutes so long as it doesn't violate federal law. So you could of course have higher standards in a state than federal law, even if the federal law just sets a baseline.
You could also have concurrent penalties. So it could be that Tennessee, for instance, has less stringent data breach laws, but if you're found to be not in compliance with both its laws and the federal government's laws, you could face double fines if that's how they've decided to structure their their penalty system.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's something we're thinking about when we're, you know, we mentioned, can we bring in the strictest law? Well, I think as a lot of people would like that. Elizabeth Warren has introduced a bill that would do something similar, but we have a Republican-controlled Senate and a Republican-controlled Congress, and once the process starts watering things down, we could end up at the end of the day with a breach notification law that doesn't require that much at all.
That confuses me, because I go to defense hearings, I go to finance hearings, and what I hear a lot is Chinese data breaches, right? We're being hacked by our enemy. And the people that are saying that are on both sides of the aisle, but they're predominantly Republican, and they're predominantly fairly conservative Republicans. And so I find it interesting that on the one hand, you might have a group of people who says, oh, government's hacking our data from elsewhere is bad. But then on the other hand, we need to protect companies when they don't report that their data is being stolen.
So I think at the heart of this, I mean, I'm not taking political sides in the matter, but I think in terms of cybersecurity, especially, and in this case, particularly breach law, there really shouldn't be like a political, there shouldn't be like political sides taken on this matter. I think we should all be in agreement that it is for everyone's best interest to have these. Mm-hmm. I mean, the penalty is really to no one. It strengthens, I mean, while some companies are reticent to release breaches because they don't want to have customers lose faith in them, it in the end ends up contributing to greater cyber hygiene overall in the United States. It helps, you know, you as a consumer make smart choices, but it also makes these firms make sure that they're disclosing and are able to get the help they need. Perhaps they need government to help step in and shore up their defenses. But, you know, it's kind of, I feel like it's something that needs to cross the aisles. It should not be something that becomes picked by one or the other political party, really.
Maybe not, but we have a Republican Party in power that seems very concerned about the strength of our regulations in that, you know, they see them as a burden on these businesses. And I think that there is a concern in the Republican Party that if we put in new notification requirements, then we're putting this extra burden on companies.
The irony there is that this is a burden that is placed to make literally everyone safer, including other companies operating in the same field, right? I think this reticence comes from a general lack of understanding about the topic and just a lack of literacy, right? I mean, not to bring up pop culture, but you watch the Zuckerberg hearing and you see a bunch of 80-year-old senators asking simple questions about the fundamental use of an internet service.
Yeah, it was embarrassing.
It's shameful that those are the people that are designing our cybersecurity law because they don't get it, and it's going to hurt everyone.
Right. I mean, I would certainly agree with that. I mean, there's just not a tech literacy in the government. For mm-hmm. I mean, most people who hold like public office, you know.
Yeah.
I mean? Obviously, there are some who are like pretty stellar at it.
Certainly, there is a range. There is a range.
Yeah. I mean, certainly, you know, I'd say there's people on both sides that actually have a decent knowledge on cybersecurity issues. But I mean, if you don't educate yourself properly on it, I mean, you see it probably just in the way you already view the world, mm-hmm. you know, and you see it not as an issue of cybersecurity or security, you see it as an issue of like government regulations on a business rather than a
coming for the small dude on the internet.
Yeah, so I think it's more just people don't completely understand the subject matter. Mm-hmm. It's a hard subject matter. I mean, the end goal of the day of like, you know, my podcast and hopefully a lot more people like in public policy is to help educate the public on cybersecurity issues and try to get a better sense of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And part of the problem is that tech illiteracy doesn't just exist in government, it also exists in the private sector. And so that these CEOs, who are theoretically supposed to be either hiring good IT staff, or at least putting some mandates for that staff to put these cybersecurity requirements in place, don't understand the risks, and don't understand necessarily what they're supposed to do if malicious attack does happen. And I think that that's an argument that people bring up sometimes when we're talking about why those regulations would be helpful, not as a burden for businesses, but as kind of a guidebook for businesses, so that, you know, they could say like, oh, I, you know, a breach happened, what am I supposed to do? Okay, well, I can look to this law and see,
yeah,
like,
a best practices list for, so you've been hacked, what do you do?
Right.
That sort of thing could be greatly helpful.
Mm-hmm. Whereas, right now, with Mark Zuckerberg's hearings, everyone's mad at Mark Zuckerberg. But Mark Zuckerberg is not able to point to a law and say, like, look, I know you're mad, but I did that, I did that, I did that, because there's no law he can point to.
That's fair. It's really, I mean, it's a lot of norms. I mean, that's the whole point, is that a lot of this stuff wasn't baked in. That's the whole point, though. A lot of this stuff wasn't baked in when we, you know, made the internet, when we made a lot of our computers and technology. We didn't think about security at first and kind of had to add it in. And mm-hmm. that sort of philosophy is grown into basically everything. I mean, you start up a business from your house, you know, running it online. You're probably not thinking about the potential for breaches. You know, if you're running all that data yourself, you know, that's probably not something on your mind.
Yeah, but before we started the podcast, we were talking about improper web design and just bad web security that comes from simply how you name and store your information on the internet. Just naming your pages in sequential order, for instance, or giving people a password that's remembered by your service might seem logical to someone new to web design, but is actually a heinous breach of security just in and of itself, because someone can just add one to their page count and wind up on something completely different.
Yeah, stuff that you were trying to protect, but you just didn't.
Yeah, yeah. Because you just didn't know any better.
Right.
You did the simple thing, and that's what people exploit.
Right.
So what is that little guy working out of his garage he described supposed to do in that situation? I mean, it seems hard to say that every entrepreneur should also have a degree in cybersecurity. At what point do businesses need to get serious about this stuff?
Well, that's definitely true. You don't want to have these people be liable if they're just starting out. They're obviously not doing it on purpose. So it's pretty hard to answer that question, to be honest with you. I think that for the most part, people who are starting up, they tend to be using sites that provide a service in general. So for instance, if I wanted to start my own business of selling like handmade, like crochet mittens or something like that, I could start my own website, or I could rely on something that is going to handle this kind of data disclosures stuff, all the breach stuff. Like I could go on Etsy to sell that, you know. Mm-hmm. So you could rely on things that are established that are going to be able to abide by these policies. I would suspect that people who are just starting up are going to rely on services that are going to provide these sort of protections or have to abide by these breach laws. And there is even a possibility of when you make these breach laws that there are certain exceptions made for sizes of the business. Mm-hmm. I think that would definitely be a reasonable exception.
Yeah, point since inception.
Right.
Age of the business.
Yeah, for instance, if you had like 50 users, probably you shouldn't be having the same standards as Google, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think there are exceptions, a lot of the state laws for size. What I more meant was I hear a lot of buzz about how companies need to bake in security from the beginning, about the way we all view security, which is like, oh, you know, we need a firewall to protect our stuff. You know, there's like, this is, cybersecurity is an additional layer to what we're doing. Mm-hmm. The fix that IT professionals have in mind is this, like, you know, bake it in from the beginning. Make sure that every step you do at the business is done with cybersecurity in mind. And so how is that practical for someone who's an entrepreneur?
So what you're really talking about is like an entrepreneur who's like selling software in that case then, right?
Or operating a website they've designed themselves, perhaps.
Yeah.
That stores user information.
Yeah, so, I mean, in terms of like software and stuff like that, I mean, I think you're entering a very fraught debate about something called cyber liability, which is not, unfortunately, there's not a lot of clear policy or law about the subject matter. A lot of people are pushing, saying, you know, if I buy software from you and I'm using it on my proprietary system and your software has vulnerabilities in it because you didn't think about these cybersecurity issues, then I get hacked and then I'm liable because I had all these people data and I got hacked because of your vulnerability. Now I lost all these people's personal information. Now I'm the one who's liable. I have to pay out all these people because of your mistake. And I think that there's a strong argument to be said about holding people who have known vulnerabilities in their data, in their like software, holding them responsible, you know, mm-hmm. especially if they're being used by somebody else who then is ultimately the one held responsible currently.
With that too, looking at an entrepreneur who's starting up and learning about web design or product design and wanting to make a software product, baking in security features is certainly a more economic long-run view, because eventually you're going to need security, and to go back and try to retroactively code in security for a insecure system is very difficult and time-consuming. You're going to have to take your product offline. You're going to have to put out a release of, hey, why my product's offline? Because I wasn't protecting all your data. And it's going to be much easier to just grow your security with your product.
Right. So at the moment, I mean, it's kind of the Wild West. It's sort of like, what risk are you, I mean, at the end of the day, it's a lot of cybersecurity. What risk are you willing to take? You know, I could go for the open source tech and use your software that's open source. I didn't have to pay for it. It's open source. But, you know, I inherit all the vulnerabilities of that because I didn't want to develop it myself and put in the time for extra security measures.
Right.
Or you didn't do that either. So I just inherit that. Same kind of deal. If I go to your website that you made yourself, you didn't use like a website generator, which I think most people would use. But let's say you're tech-savvy and decided to make your own website. I kind of have to accept some degree of risk of going to your website. I should look, see if it's abiding by best practices. An easy check would be to see if it's HTTPS versus HTTP. That would be a good indication that you've abided by some degree of security standards. But yeah, I mean, at the moment, it is just the Wild West. You kind of have to set your own tolerance for risk for products right now.
Fortunately,
people don't know how to do that.
Well, they don't know how to do that, and they're not risking their own backs. They're risking their customers' backs.
And people generally have a very hard time estimating real risk with uncertain parameters of uncertain products, like information that is personal and non-quantifiable.
Yep, I would certainly agree. I mean, it goes back, I mean, how much do you value your credit card?
Yeah. Or even, like, poor Mark Zuckerberg, right? For asking him, hey, man, how much do you think
that's what we're here to...
This is an apologist podcast about Mark. But, yeah, to try to ask him to, A, anticipate that kind of hack. I mean, if he could anticipate it, it wouldn't have happened. And then, B, to estimate the cost of it would just be... I don't know if he could make a matrix that would tell him how much to invest in PR before the hack came out, you know? It's just... Yeah, it's unrealistic to expect people to accurately estimate data or estimate risk and then judge risk going forward.
Well, I mean, people make a business of that. I mean, a lot of basically being the CISO is effectively estimating risk and seeing how much money you have to spend to deal with it.
For sure, definitely people make risk a business of it. I'm just saying, as a person, everyone is bad at that inherently. Like, it's just humans don't do that well.
And CISOs are bad at it. I mean, like, yes, they make a business out of it, but it's not a very good business. I mean, it is while it lasts, I guess, but, like, God, CISOs is such a punishing position.
They do have a very high turnaround, yes.
You're hired, and you're put in task of securing a system that, likely, as we discussed, has a bunch of legacy flaws. And then as soon as there is an inevitable hack, it's immediately your fault.
Right.
You're going to get fired.
And some of them even have a pressure. I mean, going back to the breach disclosure, a lot of them have pressure to not disclose breaches by some people. I mean, especially if it's like let's say you have like a political appointee who's on top of your agency, they probably don't want breaches disclosed.
Or if you're a big company like, I don't know, Equifax, and you have hundreds of millions of users whose information was compromised in a very, very dangerous way, and you don't want that getting out to your shareholders.
Sure.
Right.
Those are all very apt comparisons, yeah.
And the fact that they haven't been held accountable, that really just gets in my craw, you know? Just that there is not... Whether or not there's a data breach guideline, but the fact that the federal government doesn't have a method or a metric for holding companies accountable when they violate the privacy of millions of U.S. citizens is unconscionable. Mm-hmm. It's tantamount to not having law punishing auto theft.
Well, it's like you said, it's on the consumer to sue them for the neglect of their data.
Yeah,
most people, as we have kind of discussed, most people don't understand the nuances.
Or have the money, or the time.
Sure.
I mean, it's interesting. Like, what is holding them accountable? We can, like, certainly fire staff. A lot of time what happens in the event of a data breach is that there'll be a big public outcry, the CISO will get fired, then a lot of cases the CEO will get fired. And, like, okay, great. So all the people who were, quote-unquote, at fault got fired.
But the companies
weren't really at fault. B, the company's still there.
Yeah.
C, all the people's data is still gone.
And the system is still in place. The system fundamentally doesn't change because it's really the system that's at fault, not any one individual.
Well, I'm sure they tried to patch whatever caused the breach. So I wouldn't say the system is entirely unchanged. But yeah, I'd say in general it probably still has some vulnerabilities. I'm sure that the CISO probably had things that they thought were not up to scratch and informed them, and then was probably told, like, well, we don't have the budget for that. Mm. That's often the case.
And they get fired for some.
And then they get fired. Yeah, they, I mean, they end up fronting the bill.
Yeah. And then the new CISO gets the budget that they want.
But they don't inherit the knowledge from the previous guy who saw what needed to be fixed.
No. Well, sometimes. It really depends. I mean, it's a case by case. But, I mean, you do hear a lot of nightmare stories for CISOs. That's certainly the case. There's a funny acronym for CISO, but I've forgotten what it is. But basically, it's like not going to be around for very long kind of a thing.
I guess we should probably say the actual acronym for CISO. It's
Chief Information Security Officer.
Thank you.
No problem.
I did not know that.
Yeah, well, it's a relatively new addition to the C-suite. Initially, it was the Chief Information Officer in charge of all the IT issues. But for companies that were bigger, they also had the CISO, and now all companies really need one.
Mm-hmm. And the government has them, too, for all of its departments.
Yeah.
I would hope so.
Although many of those positions are not filled with the federal government, I believe that there's some federal IT staff. I believe there's one federal government CIO and one federal government CISO. I'm pretty sure I should check. The federal CISO position is not filled at the moment.
For which area?
For the federal government.
Oh, I think I actually heard that too a while ago. But I think my friend kept joking, saying, "Hey, should I apply to be the CISO?"
I mean, is that?
That's a position. To be honest, that's not a glamorous position. That's a position you're going to get held responsible for.
It's not a very...
Is that an appointment, or is that a bureaucratic position?
It's a bureaucratic position.
Okay, so that's not really, like, necessarily anyone's fault that it's not filled.
Oh, yeah, but I think people just don't want the job.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't strike me as a very useful job. Like, I mean, to a certain extent, you're overseeing all these siloed agencies. Like, what are you supposed to do? You don't have that much power to twist their arm about.
Coordinate policy, I'd say enforce minimum standards.
I'd say it's definitely important in terms of coordinating policy. And that's a lot of the times, I mean, if you don't abide by certain policy things, I mean, that's the beginning of your breach right there. But it's also, I mean, it's effectively, that's going to be a position, there's going to be a breach somewhere, and you're going to get held responsible for it.
Let me clarify. I think agency CISOs are important. I'm not sure that
one
federal CISO to oversee the entire federal government has a whole lot of ability to...
Fair. But, I mean, just to give some clarity on how common these breaches are, before Congress, a little while ago, I don't remember if it was one of the chairs for the FDIC or if it was someone from the Treasury, but basically said the Treasury Department receives over 2 million data hacks a day. And they're really minor, right? It's people throwing mud at a wall, right? A lot of it's automated. But it is there is a volume there that is considerable for the amount of sort of wolves at the Roman gates.
Yeah.
Just these wolves are bots programmed by people who want your information.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're just waiting for the next big federal data breach. There's the
Atlanta.
The OPM.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's the major one for the federal government that people keep pointing back to.
Yeah.
The OPM breach, like 1.9 million people's data. But the federal government harbors a lot of other data, especially in medical data and education data. And those sources are just sitting there waiting for somebody to...
Yeah. The one good thing to say about education data is it's pretty poorly collected, so not super useful to anyone who gets their hands on it, but...
I wouldn't say that, necessarily. You'd be surprised at how much valuable information there is.
Okay. I guess I'm just thinking from an econometric perspective of, like, I can't do anything with this. We're running regressions, but I guess that's not what you're trying to do when you're stealing data.
Not useful for beneficial actors.
Yeah.
But useful for malicious actors.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely a couple of advanced persistent threats that would find the Department of Education's information interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
So, Jacob, before we stop, I wanted to ask you more about the CyberCorps that you mentioned at the beginning.
Yeah.
So can you tell me a little bit about that program?
Yeah, so the CyberCorps is a scholarship program. It's run throughout the U.S. Some colleges do it, some don't. GW happens to be one of those. Basically what it is it's a scholarship program where they pay for your undergraduate to graduate or possibly PhD up to 3 years. And basically it's a scholarship. It's full ride. They give you a stipend for research, for living, all that good stuff. And it allows you to pursue cybersecurity specifically. you know, there's people who do forensics, but, you know, I do more mainly like sort of policy and law in the end. Mm-hmm. But yeah, basically it's a scholarship. It really is to help make people more cyber literate. And then at the end of your scholarship, after it's over, you are expected to work that many years in the government afterwards. So it's really kind of training future cybersecurity professionals and then giving them an inlet to government work, basically.
Cool.
Very cool. Do you know if someone in our wonderful public policy school here who is interested in cybersecurity policy would be able to go for something like that?
Yeah, certainly. I think that's a great thing to do. If you have the chops for it, there was an application. You have another year.
All right. Well, we'll include that information in our description for this episode. So if you're curious, you can go check it out.
Yeah, applications are every year. So, I mean, I would definitely try it. Always need more people.
Yeah. All right, well, Jacob, is there anything else you wanted to mention before we free fish tonight?
Just, you know, if you're interested in what we're talking about and want to hear more from people that aren't me and more experts on the subject, you can always listen to Decrypted. It's DC and then RYPTED. Decrypted.
Yeah, cool. For sure.
I like that.
Yeah, thank you. I made that myself.
See what you did there. We'll also include a link to that podcast so that you can check that out maybe after this one, maybe if you need some more podcast listening.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for coming. So thanks to Jacob Seida for coming to talk to us about data breach policy, and thank you for listening to GW Wonkast, brought by the Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. For more wonkiness, you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our handle on all the platforms is at GW Wonkast. You can send us love letters or hate mail at wonkast@gmail.com. And be sure to rate us and subscribe. We're now on Stitcher Radio, Google Play, and iTunes. Today's show was produced by Maggie Gallagher and edited by Eli Richman, with music by Pelle Gunther. Thanks for listening.